It's 101, so it's time to get started. 10:01 in L.A., where Rabbi Dr. Yaakov Yellen is, although I don't think he goes by those titles normally, but we'll officially introduce him that way. A smicha from Moshe Feinstein. It's a big Talmud Chacham and served for many years as the chief compliance officer, lead lawyer at Walt Disney Corporation. And he just retired not so long ago, and is a great friend of Torah Moshe, attends many of our classes, and as we have had the pleasure of traveling together. We were recently last summer in Portugal together, one of our many trips that we've had together. So it's really a pleasure. And so he just published a book on Jewish business ethics, and it's got the introduction by Bob Iger, who was the CEO of Walt Disney, and Mark Shapiro, who's the CEO of Torah and Motion Travel, and really it was Mark who suggested. I didn't even know Dr. Yellen is so modest. I didn't know. I mean, I knew he worked at Walt Disney. I knew a lot of things, but I didn't know he had written a book and all these other things. And he suggested we ask him to speak. So it's really a pleasure to bring one of the friends and participants in Torah in Motion to come and begin that with 3-week series on business in the world. It's an important topic, a very important topic, one dear to my heart. And after, I think, enough introduction, Dr. Yellen, we look forward, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all yours.
Thank you, Rabbi Kalman. That's a very generous introduction of you. I appreciate it. Just for the commercial part of the program, here's the book. It's available on Amazon. Just put my name in book and it will come up. Fortunately, there's no one else named Yaakov Yellen who wrote a book that's on Amazon. And I definitely do consider myself a great friend of Torah in Motion, and have a lot of hakaras latov to Torah in Motion for the great trips, and also for the amazing Torah that I've been privileged to learn over the years with Mark Shapiro and many others on Torah in Motion. So thank you for that, and it's a pleasure to be here. I thank everyone for tuning in. I don't know what the word is now these days on Zoom, but thank you all. So first, I guess, a disclaimer, since you mentioned my position at Disney. I retired at Disney from Disney after 31 years in April of 2021, and I have no responsibility for any of their ethical standards or conduct after that point. Before then, yeah, you can talk to me about it, but since then, it's someone else's headache, not mine. In any event, let me start with a little bit of background. It's background to the book, but it'll also explain what I intend to cover today, and that is the first of the three-part series. Really, are ethics distinct from halacha in Judaism? And we'll explore that topic throughout the program today. So, and by the way, what I'm going to tell you now is all in Bob Iger's foreword to the book, the first part. And that is, in 1991, the United States passed the federal sentencing guidelines for corporations. This was sort of the post-Watergate era. Congress became concerned about unethical, even criminal activity in the conduct of business in the United States. And then they passed the sentencing guidelines for corporations. They had already passed it for individuals. What this did is it said, if corporations commit criminal activity, their penalties are according to a certain schedule. And there was mitigation if you had an effective program to detect and deter criminal activity. And thus companies did so. They established programs, ethics programs, standards of business conduct programs. So I was a lawyer at Disney. The general counsel at the time knew of my rabbinic background, and I think that's why he asked me to set up an ethics and compliance program at Disney, and I did so. And I wrote Disney's first standards of business conduct, which was a code of ethics for Disney employees worldwide. And then when I was doing my doctoral work, I thought about, you know, what is my dissertation topic was going to be. And with some assistance from Rabbi Dr. Byron Sherwin, Olive Shalom, I said, you know, it would be really interesting to develop a code of conduct for business, not according just to American law and concepts of ethics, but according to Jewish tradition. Now, I say Jewish tradition rather than Jewish law, or halacha, because that is really the core of what I want to talk about today. And that is, I could have said halacha, but you have to deal with the fundamental issue, which is the general subject of today's program. That is, when we talk about a code of conduct according to Jewish tradition, are we talking about according to halacha? Is that what you would say a code of conduct should be? Or is it something more than that? Now, when I wrote Disney's Standards of Business Conduct, it was divided into two sections. There was a separate section on standards of legal conduct, and there was another section on standards of ethical conduct. And what I used to do when I used to teach, and that's what I did, our rabbi at our local shul called me the Mashgiach Ruchni of Disney to describe sort of what my job was. What I used to do when I would teach the standards of business conduct to Disney executives all over the world was I would use the floor and ceiling analogy, that law is the floor below which you cannot go. It's the absolute minimum standard of conduct that you must observe. And ethics is the ceiling. It's the higher level to which you aspire to that goes beyond the mere observance of law, but a higher standard of conduct. So that's the way I used to describe it. So the question for today is there a halachic standard that is different than an ethical standard according to Jewish tradition? Do we have a different standard for observance or for fulfillment of mitzvahs, that one is based on halacha and there's a different standard based on ethics? So this is the way I put it in my book, and I won't read very long, but let me just explain what the question is. The question is this: is there any role at all ethics in Judaism? If Judaism is a legal system expressed through the halacha, what need is there for ethics? Since halacha already defines how man and woman, of course, must act in all phases of existence and governs his social relationship and his relationship with God, it would appear that there should be no further need or place for ethics. If every phase of existence is directed by divine law, why would one need other guidance? Thus, if halacha is the dominant guiding force in the life of a believing, observant Jew and occupies the field of Jewish behavior, the obvious question that remains is, what need is there for ethics? And that is really the question. If we observe halacha and that is supposed to direct every phase of our existence, is there any room for ethics? Is there any meaning to ethics within the concept of the halachic system? If Judaism is a legal system, and I believe indeed it is, it's not merely a religion, it's a legal system, then where does ethics come in? What role is there for ethics? And I want to use for the moment the example of Musar. Musar, of course, is a movement that started in the 17th and 18th centuries, and essentially it's a movement of ethical conduct. It was a concept that mere in quotes, because it's not mere, it's a big deal, but it's the idea was that observance of halacha by itself was not sufficient. There was some level level of behavior, standard of behavior that would be beneficial to Jews, if they followed the Musar tradition. In the 19th century, there was an attempt to integrate the Musar movement in the great yeshivas of Europe, in Volozhin and in Brisk. It was an attempt to integrate the Musar system or the Musar approach into the yeshivas of Europe, the great yeshivas of Europe. Now, so let me start with a quote from Rabbi Soloveitchik in his Halachic Man as to the reaction of the Rosh Yeshiva in Volozhin and in Brisk to the attempt by Rabbi Yisrael Salanter to integrate the Musar system into the yeshivas, and this will make it clear what Rabbi Soloveitchik's perception was of the concept of the Musar movement and what its role was. As you will see, he didn't think very much of it. So let me share the screen here. Let's see, screen sharing, is this there? Yes, okay. Can you see the quote that I have up? Either nod, somebody nod and tell me they can see it. Yeah, okay. So this is a quote from Halachic Man and is a clearly expresses Rabbi Soloveitchik's concept of what he thought of the Musar movement. So I'll just read the highlight. And the highlighting is my highlighting, just to be clear. The entire quote is from Halachic Man, but the highlighting is mine. So the world perspective of a priori halacha, which man carries within his consciousness, was the primary factor in the refusal on the part of such halachic men as Reb Chaim of Brisk, Reb Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, the Netziv of Elazhin, and such like, to admit the Musar movement, the Musar program of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter into the yeshiva of Elazhin. And I go down, the halachic man of Brisk and Elazhin sensed that this whole mood posed a profound contradiction to the halacha and would undermine its very foundations. One must not waste time on spiritual self-appraisal, on probing introspections, and on the picking away at the sense of sin. Such a psychic analysis brings man neither to fear nor to love of God, nor most fundamental of all, to the knowledge and cognition of the Torah. So as you can see, that was not something that he thought very much of. He just felt, Rabbi Soloveitchik felt, that this was not something that was necessary, given halacha, given the breadth of halacha, that it was not necessary to have the Musar system in place. So now, hold on, let me see. I'm going to stop sharing this one. So that was Rabbi Soloveitchik's approach. Now, one possibility, and indeed Rabbi Soloveitchik accepts this, as you'll see in a moment, is that ethics is only necessary and appropriate. By the way, I see some questions in the chat. I will leave some time at the end to go through those questions, but I'm not going to address them now. So please feel free to post your questions, and I'll be happy to try and answer them at the end of the year. So one possibility, and indeed Rabbi Soloveitchik accepts this, is that ethics is only necessary and appropriate for a person who has a spiritual problem. For one who is halachically competent, however, the study of ethics is neither necessary nor even appropriate. So again, as you'll see in a second, Rabbi Soloveitchik's approach was, you really don't need ethics if everything is fine. If you have a problem, then ethics, you may have to resort to Musar and to ethics. So let's share this screen. Okay, so here's, again, this is also from Halachic Man. Excuse me. Rabbi Chaim, before Rabbi Soloveitchik talked about the attempt to bring the Musar movement into the yeshivas, now he talks about the reaction to Rabbi Isaac Blaser, Yitzhak Blaser, who was a strong proponent of the Musar movement. And the Rabbi Blaser came to Elazhin and actually to meet with the Netziv in an attempt to introduce Musar into the program at the yeshiva. And he was refused. And Rabbi Soloveitchik talks about that refusal as to what the reason for it is. And he said, Rabbi Chaim of Brisk's reply to Rabbi Yitzhak Blaser when the latter came to Elazhin in an attempt to persuade the heads of the yeshiva to introduce the study of Musar into their academy is well known. Rabbi Blaser, in support of his position, cited the statement of sages, a man should always incite the good impulse to fight against the evil impulse. If he subdues it, well and good. If not, let him study the Torah. If he subdues it, well and good. If not, let him remind himself of the day of death. So someone comes and he has a problem. First, and he has a problem with his Yetzer Hara. First thing he should do is let him study Torah. And if that doesn't work, let him contemplate and focus on the day of death. So Rav Chaim replied, if a person, so he was trying to get him to accept the Muslim movement, saying that this will, for those people who need it, this will be a wonderful thing to introduce ethical content, introduce Musar into the yeshiva. And So Rabbi Soloveitchik quotes Rav Chaim's reply. Rav Chaim replied, if a person is sick, of course, this is his ancestor, Rabbi Soloveitchik's ancestor. If a person is sick, we prescribe castor oil for him. So you see the simile or the metaphor is Musar being castor oil. However, it is certain that if a healthy person ingests castor oil, he will become very sick. If that vile wretch, the evil impulse, meets you, and if you are sound in spirit and soul, if your consciousness and character are still whole and intact, occupy yourself with the Torah, drag him to the study house. This is the most effective and tried remedy in man's ongoing battle with the evil impulse. However, if you are spiritually sick, if a fit of madness has seized hold of you, if some psychic anomaly has put forth its diseased tendrils in your inner world, then you must use more powerful drugs. Those are designed for the very ill, the remembrance of the day of death. We in Volozhin, thank God, are healthy in spirit and body, are whole in our Torah. There is no need here for of castor oil. If the scholars of Kelm and Kovna feel compelled to drink bitter drugs, let them drink to their heart's content, but let them not invite others to dine with them. So you can see it's not exactly a very welcoming response to the Muslim movement. He compares it to castor oil. And if you're sick, if you're not well, okay, then you need it. But if you are well, and if everything is going great, and you're learning and you're observing halacha, you don't need Musar, and in fact, it could be detrimental. Now, of course, to be fair, you have to remember they're talking about in the yeshiva environment. This not necessarily for the general public, but I think you see the attitude. The attitude is we don't need it. If halacha serves everything we do, if we observe halacha, then fine. Then there's no need to occupy oneself with ethical issues. Now, so that's one perspective. Another perspective really sees law and ethics as part of the same whole, but considers law to be the minimum standard. This, again, is the ceiling floor analogy that I talked about, that I used with the Disney executives, while ethics is aspirational. So the floor is law. Ethics is more aspirational, to have man reach a higher level of conduct and perfection. Put another way, perhaps law generally promotes good deeds, while ethics promotes good individual character. This is a perspective that was written about by the late great English scholar Louis Jacobs, who absolutely, I hope you are familiar with his writings. He's a very prolific writer, wrote some really interesting works. And he wrote a lot about ethics. And this is from his book, Jewish Ethics, Philosophy and Mysticism, the next quote. And here's what he writes. The detailed rules and regulations found in the sources of Jewish law provide a kind of minimum standard for Jewish conduct. But each Jew is expected to rise above the bare minimum, and that is where ethics come in. The differences between law and ethics can be briefly stated. One, law, as we have just noted, is concerned with minimum standards. Ethics demands something more. And I go further down. Law provides rules for all Jews. Ethics is more individualistic, encouraging each person to realize the best of which he is capable. For instance, the law demands that every Jew must give charity, but leaves the amount given to the individual. Ethics demands that each individual should be as generous as the circumstances allow. In law, the emphasis is on action. Certain deeds are good, others bad. Ethics, though also concerned with action, tends to place the emphasis on the formation of character. For instance, the law commands men to be generous to one another and not to steal from one another. Ethics seeks to promote the kind of character which has no desire to steal and which automatically responds to cries of help without being ordered to do so. And here is the reference if you're interested in looking it up yourself. In any event, so that's another perspective, and that perspective is the floor ceiling perspective, which I think Louis Jacobs really personifies in his writing. Another point of view is expressed by Walter Wurzberger, the great Walter Wurzberger, great scholar and Rav for many years, passed away not too long ago. His perspective is that halacha merely provides the foundation. It is a necessary but not a sufficient condition for the attainment of religious ideals. So halacha is wonderful. You must observe it, but it isn't enough. Observing halacha sort of gets you to the minimum level, but if you want to go to the next level, then you have to deal with Jewish ethics. And in fact, Rabbi Wurzburger says that he heard actually from Rabbi Soloveitchik, although he says he doesn't remember when. He says he heard that Rabbi Soloveitchik said that halacha is not a ceiling but a floor, which is very interesting because that's the analogy that that I used to use. But in any event, in his work called Ethics of Responsibility, he sets forth his concept of what it is. So, and here's what Rabbi Wurzburger said. I look upon halacha as an indispensable component, but not as coextensive with the full range and scope of the Jewish normative system. In my view, Jewish ethics encompasses not only outright halachic rules covering the area of morality, but also intuitive moral responses. It's very interesting that he uses the word intuitive, suggesting that there's some natural law component to this. Intuitive moral responses arising from the covenantal relationship with God. So if you have the covenantal relationship with God, there is an intuitive moral response, he suggests, that is beyond the level of halacha. To use Eric Fromm's terminology, Judaism provides for an ethics of responsibility as well as for an ethics of duty or an ethics of obedience. I'll talk a little bit about later about the concept of duty and whether there's a greater concept in halacha, in Jewish thought. I saw there was a suggestion of Lufim Ashur Sadin in the chat. We'll get to that. But this is Walter Wurzburger's concept of what ethics is. In other words, it's some elevated moral response beyond the core requirements of the halacha. Now, of course, this suggests and implicates the concept of Lifnei Meshur Sadin, the idea that you go beyond the letter of the law. So let's look at Lifnei Meshur Sadin for a minute. So there's a Gemara, in Bab Metzia, which is generally acknowledged to be the source of the idea of Lifnei Meshur Sadin. So let's go there for a moment to that Gemara. Let's see. Okay, so here's the Gemara that talks about Lifnei Meshur Sadin. The issue, just to set the background of it, is there is a discussion in the Gemara immediately preceding the section as to whether people who are of great stature or people who are elderly must participate in burial. So it's a mitzvah, havas hames, there's a mitzvah of making sure that Jewish people who have passed away are buried properly. And the question that the Gemara is dealing with here, this is Bava Metzia 30b, as you can see on the screen, the question is, do they have to, elderly people or people of great stature, Talmidei Chachamim, do they have to involve themselves in the burial? So the Gemara says, and I'll read the English, the Hebrew is there too, it was taught in the Braisa that they must perform, talking about the people who assist with burial. That is referring to acting beyond the letter of the law. As Rav Yochanan says, Jerusalem was destroyed only for the fact that they adjudicated cases on the basis of Torah law. So Gemara asks, what else should they have done? I mean, they're supposed to, that's their job. They're chachamim, they're supposed to adjudicate cases based on law. So what did they do wrong that they didn't adjudicate the cases based on law? Rather, what else should they have done? So the Gemara says, should they rather have adjudicated cases on the basis of arbitrary decisions? You know, this translation by Safaria, Dine de Magiz, the Magizisa, they translate it as arbitrary decisions. Others say it's the law of the Magians, which is a group that was in Eretz Yisrael, or in Bavel, really, previously. So rather say that they established their own rulings on the basis of Torah law, the law of the Lefan of Meshuras, Lefnim Meshuras Adin. They did not go beyond the letter of the law. So here's where the concept of Lefnim Meshuras Adin is actually stated in the Gemara in this concept. So we have this idea that there is a value or even a requirement, the Gemara suggests, of going beyond the letter of the law. So maybe, in fact, that is what ethics is. We'll get to that in a minute. It's interesting to note, by the way, that in the Sefer Mitzvot Katan, Isaac of Korbel, he includes Lim Meshur Sadin as one of the 613 mitzvahs. So he really takes I don't want to say it's an extreme position, but a position that Lifnim Meshur Sadin is not only something going beyond the letter of the law, but he includes it as one of the 613 mitzvahs. That is clearly not the prevailing opinion, by the way, but it does show the stature of which this concept of Lifnim Meshuras Hadin is held. Now, the Ramban, Nachmanides, also explains a verse in the Torah as setting forth the concept of Lifnim Meshuras Hadin. So let me go there. And this is a quote from the Ramban on the Torah on Devarim. On Devarim, it's in Chevelle's translation on page 88. So let me go there. And this is the Ramban's commentary on the verse in Devarim, which talks about what the obligation is to do. So here's what the Ramban says. Our rabbis have a beautiful medrash on this verse. They have said, I think the verse is Vasisa Yashrev Atov Ve'enei Hashem. You should do what is right and what is good in God's eyes. So the rabbis have a beautiful medrash on this verse. They have said this refers to a compromise and going beyond the requirement of the letter of the law. So even where he has not commanded you, where God has not commanded you, give thought as well to do what is good and what is right in his eyes, for he loves the good and the right. Now, this is a great principle, for it is impossible to mention in the Torah all aspects of man's conduct with his neighbors and friends and all his various transactions and the ordinances of all societies and countries. But since he mentioned many of them, he reverted to state in a general way that in all matters, one should do what is good and right, including even compromise and going beyond the requirements of the law. Other examples are the rabbi's ordinances concerning the prerogative of a neighbor to have the first option to purchase nearby property, dina de bar mitzvah. Now, this is an interesting idea, and let me elaborate on this for a little bit. This will be in another lecture, but I have identified 18 different ethical principles in Judaism that go beyond the letter of the law. And Lefnim Meshuras Hadin is one of them. But let me just talk about Dina de Bar Mitzvah for a minute. The Dina de Bar Mitzvah it says Dina, which generally means law. It's the law of the neighbor. And what this is that in halacha, in Jewish law, if one wants to sell his field, and there are two purchasers. One is the seller's neighbor who has the adjacent field, and one is not. One is some buyer who comes from another city, let's say. As a matter of law, the seller has the right to sell his field to anyone he wants to. It's his field, and he can sell it to whoever he chooses to. However, there's an ethical standard that the Ramban is referring to here. That it is virtuous. It is a good thing. It is an ethical thing to do to sell your field to your neighbor. The concept being that the neighbor has sort of a first call on the field since he's close by. You know, it always interests me that when we if you've seen in the benching in the blessings after meals, if you see there, there's a bracha there. If someone is being hosted by another person, there's a special bracha that he makes for his host. And one of the brachas, one of the elements of the bracha is that his host's field should be close to the city, so he doesn't have to travel far to go to them. So there's this concept of proximity, a physical proximity of being a virtue. So there's this ethical concept of dinah de bar mitzvah. So the Ramban is using that as an example, saying that this is not a requirement of law, but it's an ethical standard. And the Torah did not define everything man can possibly do through the halachic system, which is an interesting statement in itself. And therefore, yes, thank you. Someone added in the chat that as long as he's willing to pay the same price, and that is correct. You don't have to take a lower price, but if the neighbor is willing to pay the same price, you have an ethical obligation, if you will, to sell it to the neighbor. So again, this is the Rambam statement. I find it very interesting because it's a recognition that halacha can't possibly include everything. Others might disagree and say the halacha does almost include everything or almost everything. But Ramban is saying that it can't possibly include everything. So it gives you the standards, and the rest are really ethical obligations to go beyond the letter of the law. Now, I'm not going to go fully in depth into Lifnim Meshurat HaDin, but I will touch on the topic. So the concept of Lifnim Meshurat HaDin, going beyond the letter of the law, which is what Lifnim Meshurat HaDin means, comes from a Gemara in Baba Metzia. And let me show you that Gemara, and we'll talk about it for a minute. So this is actually a very fascinating part of the Gemara. So let me give you a little bit of background. You know, as a lawyer, and before I was chief compliance officer, I was a litigator for Disney. You're always dealing with expert witnesses, experts. This is a Gemara, and you know, it's amazing. If you go through the Gemara, there's everything is in it. This Gemara deals with the liability or the potential liability of an expert who turns out to be wrong. So there are various discussions leading up to this section that I want to go into on the Lifnim Meshurat HaDin, discussing the liability of an expert when he turns out to be wrong. So there is a section on a rabbi who rules on a specific piece of meat. There's a question as to whether it's kosher or not, and he rules that it is, and then it turns out it's not. That is, he liable. This section deals with a question of an expert on minted coins. And the question is, if someone brings a coin to an expert, the expert says, this is a good coin. It's not counterfeit. It's a genuine coin. And then the person who goes to the expert tries to use the coin and finds out that the expert was wrong, that the coin was bad. And the question is, does the expert have liability for telling the person that, for assessing that the coin was valid and genuine when it was not? And the Gemara says there are some differences. The question is, how expert was really the expert? If he was a real good expert, known expert, and he makes a mistake, he may not be liable. On the other hand, if he was just a novice and he made a mistake, he is liable. There are also discussion of whether it's done for a fee or it's not done for the fee. So the Gemara tells this story. The Gemara relates, and I'm right here, there was a certain woman who presented a dinar to Rab Chiya to assess its authenticity. He said to her, it is a proper coin. So this person, this woman comes, wants to know if a coin is genuine, a good coin, legal tender, and Rab Chiya says, yes, it's a valid coin. It's all good. The next day, she came before him and said to him, I presented it to others. They told me that it is a bad dinar and I'm not able to spend it. So obviously she wanted to know whether this coin was usable. Maybe she was questioning whether she should accept it or not. She did, based on Rav Chiya's opinion. Rav Chiya says it's a valid coin. She then goes into the marketplace, tries to use it. It doesn't work. And she comes back to Rav Chiya and says, this is a bad coin. So what does Rav Chiya do? Rav Chiya said to Rav. Rav was Rav Chiya's nephew. The great Rav was Rav Chiya's nephew. Rav Chiya said to Rav, go exchange it for her and write it on my tablet. In other words, put it on my account. Give her back the money. Give her the money that coin was worth. In other words, Rav Chiya accepted liability for his bad conclusion that the coin was valid. And he said to Rav, give her back whatever the coin was, give her the equivalent value and put it on my account. So then the Gemara asks, but what is different about Danku and Yisur? Danku and Yisur are interesting. They are two experts who the Gemara discusses before that if experts are on the level of these two who are known reputed experts, so if they're on that level, they make a mistake, they're not liable because they are true acknowledged experts. The Gemara says, what is different about Danku and Yisur, who the Gemara previously said who are exempt due to the fact that they do not need to learn about assessing currency? In other words, they're real experts. They already know everything there is, so they're not liable. Rav Chiya presumably was at the same level. Rav Chiya too did not need to learn as he was also an expert. So why is Rav Chiya liable? Why did he tell his nephew, Rav, to give her back her money when in fact he wasn't liable because he was a true expert? So the Gemara responds, Rav Chiya was not actually required to return a dinner to this woman, but when he did so, he acted lifnim mishuras hadin, beyond the letter of the law. This is as that which Rav Yosef taught concerning the verse, and you shall show them the way where they must walk and the work they must do, and you shall show them, this is referring to the core of existence. I won't read the rest of it, but then it says, they must do is referring to conducting oneself beyond the letter of the law. This indicates that the Torah mandates that people conduct themselves beyond the letter of the law. So this is the source where the idea of lifnim mishuras hadin, that people should conduct themselves beyond the letter of the law, it's from this Gemara. So now we know the source of lifnim mishuras hadin. Okay. Now, this, of course, raises a question as to whether lifnim mishuras hadin itself is a halachic imperative or not. And you will find disagreement about that. In other words, it may be that lifnim mishuras hadin is not an ethical standard, but a legal standard. It may be a halachic standard. So in my book, I actually spend 32 pages on the question of lifnim mishuras hadin. But for me, fundamentally, it goes back, I think, whether ethics is part of halacha or not. And this is my opinion. There are many different opinions, but I'll give you my perspective on it. It goes back to the basic perspective of halacha and how it differs from the Western concept of law. And I think that breaks down to the distinction between rights and duties. And there we find really different concepts of law in the American Western system and in the halachic system. And I believe that we can start to see that difference by looking at the American Declaration of Independence. I know we have a lot of Canadians, but you'll forgive me if I stick close to home and quote the American Declaration of Independence. And the American Declaration of Independence is known, at least in the United States, if you ask someone on the street, what do you know about the Declaration of Independence? They are likely to tell you that the Declaration of Independence has within it the concept of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So, and that is true. And I think that is what the core of the American system is. So I want to put up a quote by Elliot Dorp, who's a conservative rabbi and a professor, a wonderful man, in his book, To Do the Right and the Good, where he talks about this idea. So let me do that. Okay. That quote up. Let's see. Okay. So here is what he says. The American secular ideology with deep roots in the Enlightenment sees us first as isolated individuals endowed by our creator, which is from the Declaration of Independence, whether that be God or nature, with certain unalienable rights. And among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The ultimate truth is that we are individual with rights first and citizens with duties second. Thus, when it comes to the individual's role in social ethics, American ideology is sparse. Any of us may choose to help others, that might in fact be the part of our own pursuit of happiness if we happen to enjoy the good that we do. We do not, though, have any duty to help others, except to the extent that we have voluntarily entered into agreements to do so. Such agreements might include formally consecrated ones like marriage or informal ones like friendships. Then our duties derive from the nature of the relationship and or the specific agreements we have made with each other. Otherwise, though, we need only look out for our own life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So this actually gets to, I think, a basic concept, a basic conceptual differences that goes to the core of the different approaches of the halachic system and the American Western tradition. Let me give you an example. In American law, and I assume in the law of Canada and in the common law in general, this is the way it is. If you happen to be passing by a body of water and there's someone drowning in that body of water, do you have an obligation? Do you have any obligation to rescue that person? And the answer is that under Western law, unless you have a special relationship, for example, if you're a lifeguard or you're a parent, absent that special relationship, one has no duty to rescue that drowning person. Now, assuming that the person, there's no issue of safety, the person who's passing by is completely capable of rescuing. He's an expert swimmer, and all he has to do is maybe even just put out a piece of wood that the drowning person can take hold of, and he can pull the drowning person in. So there's no issue of danger to the rescuer. Still, under American law, if that person, the potential rescuer, does nothing and just walks by, he has absolutely no legal liability. He can't be sued for negligence, for anything else, because he simply has no duty to rescue. Of course, in halacha, that is a very different system. In halacha, we have the concept of l'tamid al dam re'echa. You cannot stand by at your brother's blood. Azov tazov imo, you must help your neighbor. You have an obligation under halacha to rescue that person. And this sets forth a basic difference between the Western legal tradition and the halachic system. And that is, in American law, in the Western legal tradition, the focus is on rights. The focus is not on duties. In Jewish law, in Jewish tradition, in halacha, the focus is on obligation, is on duties. So let's talk about that. Let me put up a quote let's see, 26:28. Screen here. So this is from Devarim, and it talks about, see this day I set before you blessing and curse. Blessing if you obey the commandments of your God that I enjoin upon you this day, and curse if you do not obey the commandments of God, but turn away from the path that I enjoin upon you this day and follow other gods who you have not experienced. So this again talks about, and I think this is the core of the duties-based approach of halacha, and that is obeying the commandments. You obey the commandments of God. You do not obey the commandments of God. This is the basic principle that there is a concept of duty. You must obey. So, and this is sort of a core difference between the American legal system and the Western legal system. So in contrast, for example, to the right to an education. So in the Western tradition, we talk about everyone has a right to an education. Judaism articulates the duty of a man to study Torah and to teach one's children, as well as the community's duty to provide schools for its children. the approach is a very different one. It's not a right to an education. It's a duty to educate. So too, the universal right to marry, which we talk about in the Western tradition as one of the universal rights. It's in the Universal Declaration of Rights. In Judaism, it's expressed as the duty to marry and to have children. So the duty-bound Jewish worldview of man and his purpose is articulated in many different sources. The basic premise is that man has a relationship with God, which manifests itself in duties to God, which defines literally man's existence. You know, the Mishnah says, this is the Mishnah talks about, this is a famous Mishnah that is often said in the shul, when you want to say an extra Kaddish, you have to say a Mishnah in order to say a Kaddish Rabbanan, a special Kaddish. So we frequently say this Mishnah. Rab Chananya ben Akasha said, the Holy One, blessed be He, desired to make Israel acquire merit. He therefore multiplied for them Torah and commandments. As it is written, the Lord was pleased for His righteousness' sake to make the Torah great and glorious. Again, He multiplied this Torah and commandments because He wanted Israel to acquire merit. We see again the emphasis on commandments, on obeying. And I think again, this is a particular difference. So I would say fundamentally, Judaism differs from Western society in its emphasis on duties, not rights. And that's a basic premise. I mean, it also has to do with Judaism's differences regarding the source of legal obligations and the goal of human life. In Judaism, the source of law is, of course, divine. It's God, not human. And the ultimate goal of life is to obey God's commandments and to live a life that is centered on the fulfillment of those commandments. By doing so, man seeks and hopefully achieves a closeness to God and becomes holy in the unique connected relationship with God. And that's the basic principle. Judaism, and I'll tie this back to the concept of what I think of halacha and ethics. So Judaism takes a different position. There's a very interesting story that is quoted. I think this is quoted in a book by Arnold Cohen, An Introduction to Civil Law. He tells a story regarding Rabbi Miller of Gateshead Yeshiva, who told him the story at a difference. To him, it illustrates, and I think it's a very good illustration, of the difference between a rights-based legal system and a duty-based legal system. He tells a story. There's a medrash that Alexander the Great, he wanted to understand the culture of one of the lands in his kingdom. And so he went to a court to see how justice was dispensed in this kingdom. And the king was presiding as judge, and there was two litigants. So the litigation is interesting. One litigant claimed that he had bought a cheap field from the other and had found on the field buried a diamond, which he felt rightfully belonged to the seller, as he intended to buy a field, not a diamond. The other litigant claimed that the diamond belonged to the purchaser, as the seller had sold a field and everything in it. So while he didn't know there was a diamond, then the diamond was there, and therefore he said it belongs to the seller. So these are two unusual litigants. They were arguing as to the advantage should go to the other party. So the king, who was sitting as judge, asked one party if he had a son and the other party if he had a daughter. When the king said that, when they told the king that yes, he suggested that they both get married and the diamond be given to them as a wedding present. This was his Shlomo-like, his Solomonic decision to said, your daughter should marry his son, give it to them as a wedding present, and everybody would be happy. So the Medrash says Alexander was astounded. So the king saw that Alexander was astounded, and the king asked Alexander, how would you have decided? If you were the judge, you don't like my decision, what would you have decided? To which Alexander replied, I would have had both litigants killed, and I would have confiscated the money or the item in dispute. So this is an interesting comment by Alexander the Great, that he didn't understand the king's ruling. He would just have confiscated. So Rabbi Miller commented on Alexander's surprising reply as follows, and I'll quote from, this is from Arnold Cohen's book. More astonishing than the original judgment was Alexander's reply. Although a successful warrior, he was no uncivilized barbarian. He was a pupil of the philosopher Aristotle, much respected by Rambam, and he was an unusual warrior who considered it worthwhile watching the administration of a foreign system of justice. How could such a man give the reply that he did? The answer is that the system of jurisprudence in Alexander's native land may have been based on the rights rather than duties of the citizen. His country may have even had a welfare state, as we know it today, based on the rights of each citizen against his neighbor. In the case before the judge, not the rights of the litigants that were stressed, it was their duties. Each felt he had a duty to concede the value of a diamond to the other. And I continue with the quote, and we'll end it here. The quote, Alexander understood the effect of such moral attitudes on the machinery and institutions of a state merely on rights. If allowed to spread, they could ultimately challenge that machinery and those institutions, which as their king, he was duty bound to protect. He did not want a system based on rights he did not want a system based on duties because that would affect his kingdom negatively. There's the famous quote from John F. Kennedy, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. I think that is literally a personification of the difference between a rights-based approach and a duties-based approach. So where do I come out on the question of whether there's an ethic outside of halacha? I would say that when you have in a society based on obligation coming from the will of God, which is the halachic system, it is likely that the concept leads to the next step. And that is, how can I serve God and what can I do to please God? How can I better serve him? And that means that you go beyond the mere minimum of halacha. Halacha is the minimum level of obeying God. But if you want to serve him properly based on the concept of loving God and the duties, the commandments that come from him, you go beyond the minimum and you incorporate the 18 ethical principles that I identified. And that is my teaser for the next lecture, where we'll talk about the 18 principles. So my answer ultimately is, in the Jewish tradition, there is clearly a concept of ethics that goes beyond halacha. Now, obviously, there are others that disagree. There's been a lot written about that. But my conclusion is that, yes, there is that system. Okay, there is the concept of ethics beyond halacha. All right, let me go to the chat. I'll also open it up. There's a link. Thank you, Rabbi Kelman in absentia, for posting that. Is ethics lifnim mishuras hadin? Yes, you anticipated exactly what I said. If it is, Chazal finds hints in the Torah to lifnim mishuras hadin. Yes, we've seen that. We've seen the reference to lifnim mishuras hadin in the Torah, and there you go. So it definitely is there. Yeah, Rabbi S was fighting, Rabbi Soloveitchik was fighting a rearguard action because ethics opens the door to women's issues, gender issues. I mean, I suppose, you can extend anything, way beyond what it was intended. And that, of course, leaves open to the question of what was intended. But I suppose you can, any parent knows that you give your kids a little bit of a permission and all of a sudden they drive a truck through it. So yes, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about legitimate within the halachic system. What is the concept of ethics? Okay. Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz. Yes, he absolutely did write about ethics. I will tell you that, he has been one of the most influential, writers on my thought. When I first read Crisis in Faith as a youngster, and I thought it was an amazing book. I think I've read everything he's written now. He is definitely a great source on this topic, just a tremendous insight into this topic and many others within Judaism. as long as he's willing to pay the same price. That was the reference to the din of the bar mitzvah. Yes, that's true. And as I pointed out, you don't have to take a loss. You're not even ethically obligated to take a loss. Now, the question you might ask yourself is it lifnim ishuras hadin to take a loss to sell the property to your neighbor if the neighbor is not willing to pay the same price? I don't think that's required or even ethically required, but others may differ. The issue with experts verifying happens all the time in the rare art world. Yes, that is clearly true. I just recently had an appraisal done on a piece of property, and you learn very quickly that an appraisal is an opinion, and two appraisers can have very different opinions on what a piece of property is worth. The question is, I guess here, the opinion just turns out to be objectively wrong, because in the case of the coin, the marketplace, which is the ultimate test, they wouldn't accept it. So yes, that is correct. And in law also, you know, you have a trial, and you have two experts, one testifies for the plaintiff and one testifies for the defendant. And clearly they can't both be right, but yet they both have great expert credentials. So it does happen. What about states that have instituted Good Samaritan laws? I don't know specifically what this question related to. Clearly states have done that, and they do. Oh, you're talking about absolving experts of liabilities. Maybe that's what it, but Good Samaritan laws, absolve. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I'm not talking about absolving. There actually are some states, including Rhode Island, it said, and Vermont, that have actually, hold people responsible to intervene in some situations where they are legally obligated to intervene.
Thank you. Yeah, now I understand. Those apply to people who have specific credentials. So if you're a doctor, for example, Good Samaritan laws exist, as I understand them, so that doctors were very reluctant to intervene. Let's say they were driving by the scene of a crash. They would be very reluctant to intervene because they were afraid they'd get sued. So Good Samaritan laws do two things often, and the laws vary in their approach. But one approach is they do impose a duty on a doctor to intervene, and they absolve that doctor of any liability from any lawsuits for intervening. So yes, that is an example of a statutorily created obligation under law. But again, that generally applies to specific people. So it applies to a doctor. It wouldn't apply to you if you're not a doctor to drive by and you're obligated. It might apply that it absolves you from liability, but it wouldn't apply in the sense that it imposes an obligation upon you to intervene unless you fall into a certain category. So there you go. And of course, a doctor, say in a hospital setting, clearly has a duty to intervene, but that's a special circumstance in a hospital setting. As I said, there are exceptions to this idea where, for example, with using the swimmer, if you are a lifeguard on duty, then yes, you have an obligation, but that's imposed by the specific situation there. So, okay, thank you for that. There's no word for obey. The word is lo sishmu, if you don't listen. Listen and obey. Again, the concept is nasa v'nishma. You listen and obey. So yes, but I think you're right. The diamond belongs to, he lost it, but it's from an unknown diamond bin, and it belongs to the buyer. Yeah, the question was, you know, what he did there. Legally, certainly today, there may be differences of opinion as to what that is. Well, thank you for that. Yes, it also includes if you see someone is drowning, you have an obligation to intervene as long as you have the necessary skills. Correct. I don't know what specifically you're referring to. It's the Good Samaritan laws. I agree. Okay. Any other questions? I'll open it up. You can do it by
About 35 years ago, I live in Canada. About 35 years ago, I visited the States, and it was Shabbat afternoon. I was walking with my cousin to the shul. And it was November, and it was slippery. A lady came with two shopping bags off a bus, slip and fell. I grew up in a home that when you see somebody needs, is in a need, you just run to do it. You don't ask questions. And that's exactly what I did. My cousin screamed at me in Yiddish, "Do not touch her." I froze. So Motzei Shabbat, walking back home, I asked him, it's against my upbringing. And he said, yeah, you are in America. Welcome. She can sue you. She can take every penny that you have. Isn't it crazy?
Yes, there are. You know, that is true. I would agree with that. But again, I think Good Samaritan laws, as was mentioned before, would prevent that. And they are, I can't say they're in all states, but they are in many states to prevent someone who undertakes rescue, from being sued for that. But I understand your sentiment.
Israel has a Good Samaritan law that requires people to help.
Oh, really? Interesting. Interesting. Yeah, I'd be interested in learning more about that. I think that makes a lot of sense. Because again, those laws are, of course, the point is, and that's my point, the point is they're only necessary. Those laws are only necessary because as a legal tradition, we don't have that obligation in the Western legal tradition. You don't need the Good Samaritan law and halacha because you are required to intervene under that system. Thank you, everyone. I appreciate
you. Rabbi.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Rabbi.
Yes.
This emphasis on individual rights versus communal rights, while you can point out the bad parts of it, and there are, is also what allows us to live in a multicultural, multi-religion society, because in a place where communal rights override, often religious communal rights are, they only recognize one religious group. So let's not say that it's all bad. There is another side to it, which allows us, like I said, for places where Jews can feel comfortable and secure practicing a minority religion.
It's a fair point. Absolutely. I guess like everything in life, the ideal situation is a balance, but clearly you have a point and I wouldn't dispute that. Thank you, everyone. Be well. Look forward to learning again next week. Be well. Have a good day. Kol tov. All the best. Bye.